Chapter 2. Continued. Longing for something more or different in a romantic relationship is often framed as naive and selfish, a way of thinking that extends to common perceptions of bisexuality. This argument is almost always a defense of the couple form, of its integrity and longevity, regardless of the fulfillment or desires of its component humans. This isn't an anti-individualism, pro-communality position, but one that seeks to protect coupledom as a dominant social form at the expense of other possibilities for intimacy. This prioritization of the couple form might involve a shrinking not only of the self, but also of more expansive intimacies and therefore solidarities. In Tori Peters' novel Detransition Baby, the character Katrina tells her partner Ames that she divorced her husband because of the ennui of heterosexuality. But because being bored is not deemed a good enough reason to justify ending a marital relationship, she tells him that she uses her miscarriage to explain the divorce. Later, when pregnant and meeting Reese, Ames' ex-partner with whom she, along with Ames, is considering raising the baby, Reese tells her that divorced cis women are my favourite people on earth. More specifically, the ones who have seen how the narratives given to them since girlhood have failed them, and who know there is nothing to replace it all, but who still have to move forward without investing in new illusions or turning bitter, all with no plan to guide them. These cis women, she says, are as close to a trans woman as you can get. The myth that there is no alternative to the prevailing romantic and sexual order is confirmed all around us, in pop songs, in advertising, on reality television. On the dating game show Love Island, conventionally attractive men and women graft to win the status of being coupled up. It could be a situationist intervention about comp het, writes Lewis, or, as the writer Rosanna McLaughlin suggests, it could be called straight camp. The programme, however, exposes the incongruity of desire with dogma. Love Islanders worship a certain denomination of love. As Simon May contends in Love, a History, romantic love has acquired a godlike significance in societies bereft of spirituality and superstition. In the wasteland of Western idols, he writes, only love survives intact. Indeed, Love Island love demands this religiosity overcome cognitive dissonance. Islanders declare their faith that the competition will result in till-death romantic partnerships against all the odds of the show's archives. Contestants are apparently evangelical about real love being monogamous, whilst Love Island's premise depends upon their multiple, often simultaneous, attractions and affections. Every year, Love Island involves a test in which the men and women who have formed couples are split up and rehoused in Casa Amor with a new set of people of the opposite sex. The idea is to test whether the couple's monogamy, seemingly assumed rather than agreed upon, can endure each of them meeting new people. If they fail the test, it follows, maybe they didn't really like each other after all. Contestant Millie, worrying about whether the man she is coupled up with, Liam, is attracted to another woman in Casa Amor, describes the stakes as whether or not what we had was real, or if it was just a complete load of crap. When Millie is reunited with Liam and discovers he has kissed another woman, she is understandably hurt. His behaviour, she believes, signals that he must not have strong feelings for her, which he contests. If a cheater explains their straying because of an already failing relationship, this fits the logic of romance narrative, observes Berlant. If they maintain that both relationships are valuable and independent of each other, the adulterer adopts the logic of fantasy, protecting all positions as sites of her own desire. Neither position is false, argues Berlant, because each is effectively true to different people. Love Island's Liam takes a different approach, retorting, "If you were my girlfriend, I wouldn't have even looked at anyone else." This, says Millie, was already her position. "I didn't even fucking get to know anyone," she tells him of her own Casa Amor experience, to which he responds, "That means the world to me, it does." The belief that honouring a monogamous partnership means shutting down or shrinking even non-sexual intimacies with other people is commonplace, and one aspect of what has been termed toxic monogamy. In toxic monogamy, romantic relationships are supposed to be our all-encompassing source of meaning and fulfillment. Partners should spend most of their time together and meet all each other's needs. Attraction to other people should cease. Sexual exclusivity is essential. Jealousy indicates love. Self-worth is to be found in one's worth to the other, and love should conquer all incompatibilities. An example of toxic monogamy might be the celebrities Megan Fox and Machine Gun Kelly's engagement, which made the headlines in 2022. He proposed using a ring designed with thorns, such that it would hurt if she tried to take it off. If monogamy and marriage are enshrined in this way, it is little wonder the tagline for Hen and Stag Do's is Last Night of Freedom. In many cases, this entails the freedom not only to have sex with other people, but to share emotional intimacy with them, especially with people of genders you might conceivably want to have sex with. The website for Relate, the UK's largest provider of relationship counselling, states that having an emotional affair might involve being excited about talking to someone, sharing news with them before telling your partner, and enjoying emotional attention and interest. Even though cultural artefacts like Love Island frequently demonstrate the challenges and contradictions of normative scripts, it is inconceivable that they would allow for conclusions that might bring those scripts into question. After all, the success of such products rests upon, as Berlant puts it, the logic of romance narrative. Since this logic can only accommodate certain effective realities, it necessarily forecloses the possibility of other ways of being. Sara Ahmed considers this in relation to the compulsion to be happy about weddings, on which £14.7 billion is spent every year in the UK. How quickly we learn, for the child, especially the girl child, her happiest day will be the moment of marrying, she writes, observing that this will be is not only a prediction, but a moral instruction that begins in childhood when heterosexuality is presumed. If a woman is unhappy on her wedding day, it follows, she becomes an affect alien, not made happy by the right things. Being an affect alien, experiencing what Arlie Russell Hochschild terms inappropriate affect, can be lonely or painful. Inappropriate affect, including but not only in the sphere of romantic relationships and sex, is, as such, often the source of shame, repressed in ourselves and policed in others. Smile, it's your wedding day. The dominant romantic and sexual order chimes with how many people experience their desires. Then again, our desires are shaped by our contexts, and when certain desires are compulsory, it can be difficult to tune in to what could, possibly, feel like more authentic ways of being. In our sex lives, as observed by Catherine Angel in Tomorrow Sex Will Be Good Again, patriarchal scripts and sexual violence, along with the pressure that empowered women should be able to enthusiastically proclaim their sexual desires, can make it difficult for women to know what they want, or to embrace the unknowability and ever-changing nature of desire. When certain ways of feeling and being are privileged, entailing social and material rewards, often as opposed to judgment and punishments, consent is called into question. We do not live in a consensual world. Non-consent is normalised at every level, writes Meg John Barker in their consent checklist, in the wider culture, our institutions and communities, our interpersonal relationships and everyday interactions, and within ourselves, self-consent. And if the alternative to the normative vision for romantic relationships is pitched as dying alone, as described by many existential dread-filled memes, how possible is it to imagine, let alone consider and practice, other options without fear? Sex and revolution. Expanding the realm of the possible in our thinking about romantic relationships and sex has much to recommend it. It is widely accepted that more freedom in this sphere up until now has been a positive. Though the horizon of liberation remains far off, gay relationships, for example, are today less persecuted than they were, and unmarried women and single mothers are subject to less discrimination than before. Despite this, even on the left, it can be hard to convince people that much more freedom is necessary. Conversations relating to intimate relationships and sex can evoke peculiarly defensive responses. Indeed, conflicts over sex often spill over into societal-level politics in moral panics. As observed by Rubin, these panics are never about what they claim to be. Because sexuality in Western societies is so mystified, the wars over it are often fought at oblique angles, aimed at phony targets, conducted with misplaced passions, and are highly, intensely symbolic. Sexual activities often function as signifiers for personal and social apprehensions to which they have no intrinsic connection. For example, the sex wars of the 1970s and 80s in which feminists battled over the meaning of pornography, sex work, and sadomasochism, and the intense homophobia whipped up during the HIV/AIDS crisis. Often, protecting the children is invoked to displace fear and hate. At the 1987 Conservative Party conference, Margaret Thatcher warned that children who need to be taught to respect traditional moral values are being taught that they have an inalienable right to be gay. Today, we see this rhetoric being used in attempts to justify transphobic views. Moral panics reveal sublimated anxieties. If women are allowed to petition for divorce on equal terms, my wife might leave me for another man. If gay people are allowed marriages, it might change the significance of my straight one. If some relationships are non-monogamous, my monogamous one might be threatened. People often find reasons to negate increasing freedoms in the intimate sphere, intentionally or unintentionally shoring up the status quo, because, on some level, we are scared that a widening of acceptable ways of being might challenge the validity or stability of the identities and relational forms in which we seek meaning and security. Moral panic might take the form of, say, launching a marriage foundation or refusing to bake pro-gay marriage cakes. Or it could take the shape of feminists attending conferences attempting to mastermind trans-exclusionary politics or people demeaning polyamory on Twitter. Ballant defines the phobic as those who fear instabilities of privilege and embrace the social as a site of sameness. In the phobic imagination, she argues, non-normative sexualities threaten fantasies of the good life that are anchored to images of racial, religious, class, and national monoculture. We are all, in one way or another, phobic. Dismantling the ways that we are is lifelong work. It isn't simply possible, by making certain choices, to opt out of the ways in which the dominant logic of romance and sex is oppressive. To a large extent, the systems we live in under capitalism predetermine the possible thoughts, feelings, desires, and ways of relating. But we can, at least, try to become conscious of the ways we have internalized the dominant culture and ask ourselves what this might mean for our lives. In progressive political movements today, unlike in the 1960s and 70s, intimate life, including sexual relationships, is rarely considered a key battleground. Fighting systems, capitalism, patriarchy, white supremacy, is considered more important political work than changing individual behaviours and lives. This makes sense. Changing our lives alone, so far as that is even possible, won't change the world. Non-normative relationships and sex are not necessarily more radical anyway. Certainly, such intimacies can mirror and recreate the oppressive dynamics common to heterosexuality. Patriarchal domination, for example, can well live on in queer couples or polyamorous triads. The tradition of all dead generations weighs like a nightmare on the brains of the living, wrote Karl Marx. And just as they seem to be occupied with revolutionising themselves and things, creating something that did not exist before, they anxiously conjure up the spirits of the past. Supposedly radical ways of relating can well be subsumed by capital. As Natasha Lennard writes in her essay Policing Desire, sexual practices, which were once considered threats to capital's reproduction through the family form and property relations, have been eaten up by techno-capital that soothes the status quo. There can be polyamorous configurations within BDSM dungeons in the basement, but the houses are owned. In the same vein, she asks, when there's a popular app for organising your next queer orgy, how rupturous of our political status quo can the mere fact of such an orgy be? But whilst the existence of non-monogamous queers won't topple capitalism, intimate practices do carry political weight. They can be praxis. To deny this can amount to a patriarchal dismissal of the political relevance of the intimate sphere, which is coded as feminine. Experiments in living and relating matter because, amidst everyday and structural violence, they can expand the realm of the possible and prefigure the future. Today's queer spaces, essential sources of joy, refuge, solidarity and resistance, have their genealogy in sexual dissidence. In 18th century London, when being queer was a crime punishable by death, under the Buggery Act, this meant any sex that wasn't between a married man and wife, there were more gay locales than there are today. In molly houses, gay men and people of multiple genders, including sex workers and other members of the criminalised underclass, met to socialise and have sex. Gender expression was fluid, feminine glamour abounded. In exuberant subversion of heterosexual rituals in which sex is obscured, Mother Clapp, in her Molly House in London, facilitated marriages, which often included exhibitionist sex in the marrying room. Houses like Mother Clapp's were frequently raided, their attendees fined, imprisoned, and murdered by the authorities. Renegade Marxist psychoanalyst Wilhelm Reich argued that the shame-laden repression of sexuality, compelled by marriage as a tie, family as a duty, fatherland as a value in itself, morality as authority, religion as an obligation deriving from eternity, was integral to capitalism's requirement for submissive workers and the reproduction of oppressive ideologies. In his 1933 book, The Mass Psychology of Fascism, which the Nazis banned and burned, he theorised that the unleashing of sexual desire and pleasure, undoing the ossification of the human plasma, would be revolutionary. From the 1960s through to the 1980s, socialist second-wave feminists in the women's liberation movement resisted oppressive sexual orders by organising consciousness-raising projects and attempting to build alternatives to the monogamous heterosexual couple and the nuclear family, which many saw as forces for women's repression. The Red Collective in London sought to develop theory about relationships and sex from a materialist perspective by practicing sexual relationships that challenge the dyadic form. "We have tried to change the interconnection between sexual, political, and domestic relations," they explain in The Politics of Sexuality and Capitalism. Three people in the Red Collective, Anne and Mary, who both had romantic and sexual relations with Pete and others, documented and analysed their experiences with non-monogamy, linking them to wider political struggles. Decentering the monogamous heterosexual couple as the nucleus of their personal lives and political organising, they found, was generative for their own relationships as well as for their group's sense of solidarity in political work. "As there was no set way of behaving or conducting relationships for us to fall into, we had to work out everything and construct the principles, and this meant working out what we wanted to do when being together, rather than just establishing a modus vivendi." Is the modus vivendi of straightness doomed? Heteropessimism, later termed heterofatalism, was coined by the writer Asa Serizin to refer to a sentiment among people, usually cis women, that considers being straight an affliction. For the heteropessimist, being straight means being condemned to relate closely and sexually with men under patriarchy, with all the violence, unequal power, laborious drudgery, boredom, and frustration that will likely entail. It was for this reason that some straight women in the feminist second wave practiced and advocated for political lesbianism. Serizin, however, argues that straight women's performative distancing from heterosexuality is usually little more than an abdication of responsibility. They conclude that, whilst universal queerness and the abolition of gender may be the horizon toward which we are eventually moving, we can't give up on heterosexuality in the meanwhile, because tens of thousands of women are currently dying of it every year. And in the same way that decrying heterosexuality per se won't change its brokenness, performative distancing from its institutions, in compulsory monogamy, marriage, and the nuclear family, won't lead to their transformation or abolition. Queering things has become memeified. On Twitter, at least, the word has become a joke, because vapid use and overuse often render it meaningless. For example, with reference to the Royal Air Force's appropriation of the Pride flag, the journalist Ben Smoke tweeted, "Queering mass murder, hashtag gay boss, hashtag love is love, hashtag bomb with pride." To queer something often equates to a shallow, aesthetic subversion of heterosexual norms, or to pinkwashing, in which conservative and capitalist institutions, such as corporations, police forces, or nation states, invoke queerness to mask harmful practices or to gain legitimacy. The normalisation of queer relationships does not signal the world's transformation away from domination and violence. As Berlant writes, LGBTQ couples becoming an ordinary event in the everyday does not mean that heteronormativity has been vanquished. It might mean that one of its qualities, the couple or the family form, for example, is ruling the moral, legal, economic, and/or social roost in such a way that other oriented practices might be held in contempt and/or illegalized. Indeed, increasing homonormativity, a politics and culture that accepts some queer people as born this way, so long as they subscribe to the norms and institutions of heterosexuality, means that some queer people can exist more freely and safely than others. For example, society is more likely to validate married cis gay men than trans people in non-traditional relationships. It is not solely the what of intimacy that holds its radical potential, but the why and how. If attempts at feminist and queer forms of relating no longer pose a threat, how can we make sexual politics a threat again? In asking this question, we might honour and learn from, as Rich writes, the history of women who, as witches, femme soul, marriage resistors, spinsters, autonomous widows, and/or lesbians, have managed on varying levels not to collaborate with patriarchal relationships. Such women, she writes, in all cultures and throughout history, have practiced resistance, as far as was made possible by their material circumstances, even though attacks against unmarried women have ranged from aspersion and mockery to deliberate gynecide, including the burning and torturing of millions of widows and spinsters during the witch persecutions of the 15th, 16th, and 17th centuries in Europe. The women Rich lists, those who have managed on varying levels not to collaborate, whilst not all LGBTQIA+, are, according to many definitions, queer. In Toward the Queerest Insurrection, Mary Nardini Gang writes, "Queer is not merely another category that can be tacked onto a list of neat social categories, nor the quantitative sum of our identities. Rather, it is the qualitative position of opposition to presentations of stability, an identity that problematizes the manageable limits of identity. Queer is a territory of tension defined against the dominant narrative of white, hetero, monogamous patriarchy, but also by an affinity with all who are marginalized, otherized, and oppressed. Queer is the abnormal, the strange, the dangerous. Queer involves our sexuality and our gender, but so much more. It is our desire and fantasies, and more still. Queer is the cohesion of everything in conflict with the heterosexual capitalist world. Queer is a total rejection of the regime of the normal." The gender studies professor, Mel Chen, too, considers queerness to be not so much about sexual contact among subjects as about social and cultural formations of improper affiliation, so that queerness might well describe an array of subjectivities, intimacies, beings, and spaces located outside of the heteronormative. For Chitty, queer is less an identity or practice and more about dissent against the state and capital, including forms of love and intimacy with a precarious social status outside the institutions of family, property, and couple form. This, he emphasizes, does not mean that apparently queer sex and deviant forms of relating are always inherently revolutionary. Indeed, they can even shore up the status quo, but that they have been and can be, depending on who is involved and at which time in history. In the senses described, ideas and practices in romantic relationships and sex might meaningfully be considered radical if they in some way disrupt hegemonic, oppressive forms of social relations and theorize and create alternatives. Personal and interpersonal ways of being may form part of this, cultivating creativity and pleasure in a world that would have us submit and suffer can be a form of resistance. For Lord, in her essay Uses of the Erotic as Power, the release and sharing of joy and fulfillment that does not have to be called marriage, nor God, nor an afterlife, not only in sex, but in harnessing deep feeling in every area of our lives, holds political potential. When we begin to live from within outward, in touch with the power of the erotic within ourselves, and allowing that power to inform and illuminate our actions upon the world around us, then we begin to be responsible for ourselves in the deepest sense. For as we begin to recognize our deepest feelings, we begin to give up, of necessity, being satisfied with suffering and self-negation and with the numbness which so often seems like their only alternative in our society. Our acts against oppression become integral with self, motivated and empowered from within. Recognizing the power of the erotic within our lives can give us the energy to pursue genuine change within our world, rather than merely settling for a shift of characters in the same weary drama. For not only do we touch our most profoundly creative source, but we do that which is female and self-affirming in the face of a racist, patriarchal, and anti-erotic society. Intimate experiences and commitments can fuel us to survive and fight forces of domination, and more consciousness about the ways we relate could open us up to more liberatory relationships with more authentic communication, consent, and connection. The Make Your Own Relationship User Guide zine by relationship and sex educators and writers Meg John Barker and Justin Hancock aims to support people to try a more consensual and intentional way of doing relationships. The authors consider how reductive our culture of love is, inviting readers to reflect upon, for example, the ancient Greeks' 7 kinds of love and where their relationships might fit into those. The zine creates opportunities for people to think through their desires and needs, including around communication, interdependence, transparency, and the relationship escalator. Rather than assuming a normative romantic relationship style, it explores a wide variety of options, including monogamy, monogamish, open relationships, swinging, and solo polyamory. Reflecting on our personal relationships may throw limiting assumptions, often with their roots in oppressive frameworks, into question. But this doesn't necessarily mean our preferences or choices will change. In examining our desires in terms of the relationship escalator, for instance, we might realise the problems with and want to challenge the dominance of this script and decide we want that kind of life regardless. Rethinking our relationships is not about inverting the existing moral order, replacing it with a new radical order. Whatever our choices, being conscious of why we are making them could allow for more intentional, connected, and free relationships, which might support us to participate more fully in the struggles of the world around us. One relationship style referenced in the Make Your Own Relationship User Guide is Relationship Anarchy, or RA, coined in 2006 by Swedish feminist and computer scientist Andy Nordgren. RA proposes that how we construct, conduct, and prioritize our relationships should be a creative endeavor. The philosophy is not one in which anything goes, as is often wrongly inferred from anarchy, but one that advocates for bespoke commitments, collaborative relationships built around the people involved, as opposed to common sense approaches and hierarchies. It seeks to remedy the fact that, as Hooks asserts, a culture of domination has raised the romantic relationship up as the single most important bond, when, of course, the single most important bond is that of community. This hierarchy is not inevitable, she argues, pointing out that marriage has often been conceived as part of, not apart from, communal life. Relationship anarchy means that traditional coupledom is not automatically deemed more important than other kinds of relationships. For some, relationship anarchy might simply mean looking afresh at a long monogamous marriage and deciding that life would be richer if friendships received a similar amount of care and attention. Or it might mean realizing that a life without the one is just as valuable and that the love of your life could be your community or yourself. For others, relationship anarchy might mean inventing relationships entirely from scratch. It could mean deciding to form a domestic partnership with a friend or freeing a romantic relationship from the traditional heteronormative markers of success or commitment. It could mean deciding to co-parent with a committed group of friends and having a romantic partnership outside of this, or more than one, or none. Or to raise children with a primary romantic partner, living alongside and supported by an intentional community of friends. Like the composition of any one human relationship, the possibilities for human relationships per se are infinite. Freedom from normative frameworks is especially important for people who are always already marginalized by dominant discourses around sex and romantic love. In challenging the narrative that sex and romantic love are universal and peak experiences, we have much to learn from asexual and aromantic people. In an aromantic manifesto, Ying Chen and Ying Tong propose that romance is inherently queerphobic because, in its heteronormative capitalist logic, many queer people are marginalized and excluded as unlovable and undesirable. In proposing aromanticism as queer counterpublic, the authors advocate for queer intimacy beyond the competition of romance, for happiness to be freed from romance, for physical and emotional intimacy beyond the monopoly of romance, for the rejection of marriage as a means of concentrating wealth, for the transformation of queer intimacy into solidarity and political action, and for new, non-violent pleasures and desires that do not yet exist. In Life Isn't Binary, on Being Both, Beyond and In Between, Meg John Barker and Alex Ian Taffy ask, what happens to our understandings of love and relationships if we challenge this binary between romantic partners and friends, and consider treating lovers more like friends and friends more like lovers? The writers also consider what harms could be avoided and what personal and political possibilities open up if we challenge other relationship binaries, together or single, monogamous or non-monogamous, romantic or sexual, and self or other. Decolonial or anti-colonial thought is instructive around more expansive ways of relating. Toulbert considers how one interpretation of sexual monogamy, when adopted as a form of compulsory settler sexuality, rather than as a mutual conscious choice, could be hoarding another person's body and desire, which seems at odds with the broader ethic of sharing that undergirds extended kinship. She posits that her ancestral indigenous Dakota principle of being in good relation with could spur more de-objectified, nurturing and just relationships, spanning more widely than the couple form and the nuclear family, indeed including non-human animals in our environments, that might fortify me and make me more available to contribute in the world. Culturally, romantic and sexual relationships hold existential significance, yet we are still afforded relatively little freedom in this sphere. By the state, by our families, by ourselves. The relationships in which we are told we will find much of life's meaning and purpose, whether we do or not, carry weight in how the world is made and remade. Our interdependencies, loving or violent, can percolate upwards to how we exist in and impact upon the world. My love, your love reinforces my fighting instincts. It tells me to go to war, wrote Angela Davis to George Jackson. The Russian revolutionary and feminist Alexandra Kollontai considered love a political force and proposed love comradeship to describe the solidarity and political movement building that is made possible through networks of commitment and care beyond the monogamous marriage and nuclear family, in which care is traditionally siphoned inwards towards the preservation of the unit. Bourgeois morality demanded all for the loved one, she writes. The morality of the proletariat demands all for the collective. Militant lesbians and gays at the end of the 1960s, including David Fernbach in Britain, suggests M.E. O'Brien, envisioned Eros as a potentially liberating source of human freedom, powering their radical political groups, fighting for causes including anti-imperialism and socialism. It was erotic solidarity, more than any shared essential identity, that would provide the praxis for a gay communism. Imagining that our most intimate relationships could exist otherwise might entail new visions for mutual aid, collective care and resource sharing, which, in turn, might build bottom-up power. Decentering the couple and the nuclear family form as the loci of quasi-commoning, and cultivating more extensive intimate commitments to and modes of sharing with those around us, including non-human beings, should better undergird our collective resilience and revolutionary movements. In shifting our outlook on love, Eric Fromm proposes we make a distinction between having mode and being mode. In societies driven by competition, ownership, and greed, he argues, having mode relationships prevail, in which each partner seeks the other like a shipwrecked sailor seeks a plank for survival. Fromm argues that such relationships are heavy, burdened, filled with conflicts and jealousies, and that this having mode extends upwards in nations that cannot help waging war. In being mode relationships, on the other hand, private having, meaning private property, has little effective importance because I do not need to own something in order to enjoy it. Nothing unites people more, without restricting their individuality, than sharing their admiration and love for a person, sharing an idea, a piece of music, a painting, a symbol, sharing in a ritual, and sharing sorrow. The experience of sharing makes and keeps the relation between two individuals alive. It is the basis of all great religious, political, and philosophical movements. Lovers for liberation. It can be very difficult to build relationships outside of normative frameworks, even if people experience non-normative desires as an essential aspect of who they are, rather than as a choice. There can be material as well as psychic and social barriers to living them out. The personal is not political because personal choices are necessarily political choices. Lenard writes, but because the very terrain of what gets to be a choice and what types of person get to be choosers, what types of persons get to be, are shaped by political power. The choice to marry or not, for instance, has not been free, most of all for women, for most of human history. And whilst the pressure to marry is thankfully weaker today for many younger people than it was for older generations, in many cases it remains, at least partially, an unfree choice. Some people are compelled to marry by tradition, culture, family, or religion. Marriage may also be a survival mechanism, for example, for those who would be unable to obtain visas, access public services, or afford to live without a legal spouse. Even for queer people, who may have only accessed the right to marry in recent years, the social, economic, and financial compulsion to marry or cohabitate as a couple is significant. In society as it stands, getting married may have irresistible or essential material benefits for buying a home, for tax relief, for social harmony, for child rearing, for pooling incomes. In short, in some important ways, being in a marriage or marriage-like relationship might make life easier. Decolonizing love, argues Tolbert, is not a simply personal decision, but something that requires us to fight battles against the structures that attempt to preempt, coerce, and fix the shape of relationships. Decolonization is not an individual choice. We must collectively oppose a system of compulsory settler sexuality and family that continues building a nation upon Indigenous genocide and that makes Indigenous and other marginalized relations as deviant. This includes opposing norms and policies that reward normative kinship ties, for example, monogamous legal marriage, nuclear biological family, over other forms of kinship obligation. Even the act of sex is, to a large extent, predetermined by our material realities. Whether someone has access to a safe home, what condition their home is in, who they live with, whether they can afford enough to eat, how much and how hard they work, how sick or exhausted they are, whether they have access to contraceptives and abortion, all these factors influence the possibilities of the erotic. Who gets to experience pleasure is a political question. As the radical queer organisers, Queer to the Left, demanded in 1990s to 2000s United States, everyone deserves a place to fuck, affordable housing now. This extends to the kinds of intimate relationships that feel or are possible. A common retort to polyamory, for example, is, who has time for that? I barely have time for one partner. Indeed, who does? In life and love, as we currently know them, sustaining more than one committed partnership might well feel difficult or impossible, whether logistically, materially, or emotionally, especially for those with less resources. As the author and educator Kevin A. Patterson writes in his book about race and polyamory, Love's Not Colorblind, so, when do you engage in all that valuable relationship-affirming communication? In the limited space between your full-time minimum wage shift and your part-time minimum wage shift? Do you find time on the phone while taking public transportation to pick your children up from school or daycare? Do you find the time after you get home from washing dishes, but before you have to write a paper for one class and study for an exam in the other? Most people struggle under capitalism to locate enough time and energy to nurture relationships at all. Being able to tend to our intimate relationships should not be a privilege. It is a devastating reality that so much of our life force is directed towards labour rather than love. While who has time for that is often a throwaway dismissal of the idea that people might maintain more than one intimate partnership, it could instead be a question of intimate justice. Rather than giving up on alternative visions for our relationships as inexorably impossible, and rather than cajoling individuals to build radical relationships that may not make sense for their lives, let us imagine and fight for a future in which multitudinous love in multivalent forms will be conceivable for everyone. Some of this political work must come from within the intimate realm itself. as it always has. The Wages for Housework campaign, launched by the International Feminist Collective in 1972, demanded that women's labour in marriage and the nuclear household under capitalism be categorised as work, and therefore its refusal as strike. They say it is love. We say it is unwaged work. They call it frigidity. We call it absenteeism, proclaimed Federici's Wages Against Housework, explaining, "We want to call work what is work, so that eventually we might rediscover what is love and create what will be our sexuality, which we have never known." To this day, such resistance is invoked in calls, for example, by the actor Bette Midler in response to the 2021 anti-abortion law in Texas, for women to mount heterosexual sex strikes as a form of protest. Structural power overwhelmingly shapes the intimate realm, but the intimate realm must also organise to challenge structural power. Whatever radical romance and sex might be, it is not simply about choices and behaviours. The possibility of meaningful agency in this sphere will not come from the proliferation of polyamorous life coaches advertising their services on Instagram, nor from the representation of queer families or chosen families in mainstream advertising campaigns. Liberation requires structural change, from secure housing for all, to freedom from exploitation at work, to free childcare. Radical sex and relationships won't topple capitalism, but toppling capitalism might just make them possible. In the meantime, no matter what kinds of relationships we are in, trying earnestly to be loving and not to treat each other like commodities would be a good start.